That's because I'm a bit shorter than Graham. I was going to start off with a joke tonight. I was explaining it to Graham earlier. I couldn't remember it, could I? So you're saved from that. But so we'll go straight into the book of Micah. And Micah's name, I'll start off with this because I'm going to end with it as well, is who is there like Jehovah? Who is there like Jehovah? And that's a great thing because we're coming in this time of Advent, heading up for Christmas. And it's a good time of the year to start thinking about who is our God. Just a few sort of comments on the book. You know, Micah, he lived roughly 25 miles away from Jerusalem. That's about 10 minutes if you're driving. He spoke at the same time of people like Amos, and his main message goes to the southern kingdom, to Judah. The people there were not quite living how they should. Some things were said about them that are greedy, materialistic. They caused the rich to get richer and the poor to get poorer. And that might give you some idea. As you go through this book, you start asking questions like, is this book actually speaking to us today? And several times I had to stop and think, this really does sound like the world I am living in, the country I am living in. So is it that the word of Micah should be preached today as well? Hopefully you might agree with me, you might not. But he's speaking to God's chosen people. What's amazing about this book, and when you look at the Old Testament, is you suddenly realise you're jumping around. And you start reading, you think, well, he's speaking God's chosen people. And when I did Exodus, one of the things that I was really trying to catch hold of was they were God's chosen people. He chose them to be his own. He gave them a law to not to pin them down and force them to do something, but to say, look, you're going to be different to everyone else. And through you, everybody else is going to come to know me. And so we get to this situation where when Micah's speaking, things have gone downhill. When Micah's talking, I think I was meant to be on slide 3 by now, but I'm not into this sort of thing, high tech, you know, it's just sort of not my thing. Paper and pen's always better. But when you look at this book, it starts jumping around. I guess it's because it's a prophecy. So Micah's talking to people at a specific time and place, and then he jumps forward and starts talking about something totally different in the future, and then he comes back again. And it's also got poetry in it. I've got to confess something. English language, English literature were not one of my strong points at school. When I picked up poetry, it's just words. When I had to do essays on, you know, what was that poem, that long one about the bird that, oh, I can't. Hey, look at that, somebody else went to school. I didn't see you there. But that was the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner coming out. Things like that, it's just words to me. I just, to be quite honest, I don't know why people bothered writing things like that. But when you read this book and there's poetry in it, you start thinking, oh no, I've got to start thinking a bit more than normal. But the other thing I noticed, and something that started coming across to me, was he's preaching. The shortest period he was preaching for was 16 years. And you think you'd get away lightly for 20 minutes from Sadu. Well, 16 years is a long time, and it's the same message. And as we go through this book, and oh, that's what I'm meant to be looking at now, isn't it? As we go through this book, you'll find that the division I'm using is in three sermons, and it's just a word sermon. Don't worry, it's not going to be three 20 minutes worth or anything like that. I nicked that from the African Bible commentary because it's a really simple commentary. I've left out some illustrations because they just don't apply. But when I'm speaking, if I jump around and say the same thing again, it's not because I'm lost, it's because Micah says the same thing more or less three times. So let's jump into it. Now the first part is literally setting the scene. And that says slide five there, and I haven't got a clue which one I'm on. There we are. So the word of the Lord came to Micah, actually sits down. It gives his word some authority, doesn't it? If Bernie Pinner stands up and speaks, he doesn't carry much authority. But when Micah speaks on behalf of God, that carries authority. So he's setting the scene saying, look, listen to what I am saying. Listen. And then he talks about God descending onto the mountains and the mountains crumbling before him and the high places descending. And to me, this was sort of almost a picture of all of creation bowing before God. And you're looking up there and thinking, he's got lost already. That'll just keep you occupied as I'm talking. But the high places are descending. Now, the high places tended to be where people built their cities. You build them up there for fortifications. But the high places are also the places where temples were built to worship foreign idols. The places where people built the altars for sacrifices. And so when we see them descending, we get this picture of God coming and dealing not only with men and their sin, but also dealing with all these different deities that they worship and coming and saying, look, there is only one God and I am he. So God comes upon this nation in this picture. And it's very much going back to Exodus, where God came and met them on Mount Sinai and brought the covenant and brought a blessing to Israel. This time he's coming and he's bringing the exact opposite. He's bringing judgment. God is angry. God is angry. And I'm going to go onto that slide there now. And through this book, there's the impression that some people aren't quite happy with using the word that God is angry. But he's angry for the sins of Israel and Judah. He's angry because they've gone against his covenant and his teachings. He's angry because they've turned their back on him. There are specific things. But first of all, Micah writes off the northern kingdom in just one go. He says, your prosperous cities are going to become a heap where vines will grow. Your idols and offerings will be smashed to pieces. God was going to deal with his people. He actually dealt with them. He dealt with them. And the rest of the book is a different story. But first of all, he turns around and he says, look, there's a mention about prostitutes. And the picture there is one of the fact that within the worship of idols, they used prostitutes and they paid money into the temples for that. He's turning around saying, look, employment of prostitutes is wrong. Deuteronomy tells you that. And some of you, because of what's going to happen to you, will be like prostitutes in your future. That is going to be what's happening. So we see a picture very much emerging where all the things that we hold on to as being safe, the places, our strongholds that we build up, are going to be torn down. We see a picture emerging of doom, desperation, despair, dread, any other lovely words like that. And Micah is intending it. It's one of the amazing things about the prophets, that he will speak out the truth because he wants to change lives. He wants to turn the people away from what they're doing and back to God. And when he talks about exile for these people, which is one of the things that God is going to bring if they don't turn round and worship him again, He's not just talking about going off for a holiday in some far country. You become slaves. It's the death of a nation. It's something so dreadful for these people because they are God's chosen people. And to have the nation totally destroyed and eradicated is possibly one of the worst things that could ever happen. Now, that should have been the one I was on earlier. I'm really having fun with this thing, you see, because I've never played one of these. It's great, isn't it? You can go backwards and forwards. It's wonderful, but you get lost on it, and I hate things like that. But why use it, then, Chris says? Michael then turns onto a part where he is mourning the people. And from this point on, he's talking to Southern Kingdom. We're in around verse 8. And he's only talking to the Southern Kingdom from now on. He's dealt with the Northern Kingdom. He said, you're going to be wiped out, eradicated, off into slavery. Now he's talking to the people that are close to his heart, the people that he longs to touch. And we get this picture of him going into mourning. He says, because Samaria was doomed, it was incurable, the disease they had. There's a chance for Jerusalem. They are infected, but there is a chance for them to be saved from the same fate, if only they repent. And all he's doing is attempting to arouse the sense of sin within them to get them to turn around again. And he identifies with them in genuine grief. It's great, this is the same picture of Jesus, isn't it? Yeah. Jesus identified with us when he came to the earth. Micah identified with the people that he's crying out for. And this whole thing about sin, it's just a note that I put down this afternoon. And I will forget the slides. If you want to see them, then come and have a look at them. But they distract me. But this whole thing about sin, because we just wonder, how can a nation fall into sin? How can a nation turn their backs on God when they've had such a wonderful future? And it's quite simply this. Sin is something often that creeps in slowly. Sin is something that creeps into our lives unnoticed very often. And so this whole nation has turned their backs on God. Specifically those in leadership, those that are ruling the country. And Mike is just turning round to them saying, wake up! Wake up to the situation you're in. Wake up before it's too late. So he then creates in the rest of that first chapter this little game that I didn't understand because it's all foreign language. Now what do they call them? Oh, crumbs, I didn't write it down. I thought you'd all know the answer to that. Where it's a word game where you take the name of something and you associate something with it. And it's totally gone out of my head, but come up and see me later and tell me what it is. But he goes through 10 cities and he says, here's the name of your city and this is going to be your fate if you don't turn your backs away from the things that you are doing. And just to give you an idea, and you'll remember back to the talk we had a few months ago from the book of Ruth, Naomi became, well done, Graham was listening, became Mara. And here we've got one of the towns that's mentioned is Maroth. And he says, yeah, your fate is going to be bitterness. Your fate is going to be bitterness. Another one talks about, yeah, your name means dust and you will roll around in the dust. If he was here today, I was trying to think of one for Gillingham, but the worst I could think of was Gillingham Football Club, but that isn't the pun that's involved. Say barking in London. Yeah, barking, your fate is going to be that wild dogs are going to come and destroy you. Right, barking, wild, something they will remember. something you catch hold of. And that's what he did in the last part of that chapter. He's just associating the name of the city and the meaning of it with the fate that was going to come to them. So hopefully the people will sit there and go, hey, he's talking about me and I need to do something. But we move on to chapter 2, where he starts talking in more detail about why this judgment is coming upon the people. It's simply that they are breaking God's laws. They promise to obey God. They promise to follow him. They want to be his people, yet now they had turned their backs on him. And sin was rife at the highest level in society. The people who were ruling had no moral standards. They were happy to defraud others. They were happy to condemn people to poverty. They were corrupt. And in the early part of that chapter, it says they were even plotting in their beds what they were going to do. So these people were not just doing something at, you know, suddenly and think, oh, just do something. It's something that they planned and prepared beforehand. Sin starts off in their heart. Sin starts off going through their mind as they plot and plan. And finally, sin caught them when they acted. But God, it says in the later verse, God was making plans for their disaster. God was making plans where they would be mocked, humiliated. They'd lose their land. Their property would become the property of their enemies. So we move on to specifics, and he talks about the false prophets. And they turn around and say, Micah, what are you up to? Yeah, this is absolute rubbish you're talking. Well, that's my version of it anyway. But they said, look, you know, God is on our side. God is our God. He would not turn his back on a covenant promise. God is with us. It's not in God's character to punish us, his own people. But as Micah tells us, the true covenant is based on faith and obedience. And these people were doing absolutely nothing to be obedient to God. So he responds to them and simply states that they are acting like the enemies of God. And it reminded me, I think it was last week, Amanda did mention Matthew 25, when she was talking about the people who said, yeah, Jesus, when did we see you hungry and not feed you and do this and not do that? And he turned around and said, whenever you didn't do it for the least of these, you didn't do it for me. And in a sense, they've become enemies of God because they failed to do what they ought to be doing to the people and those under them. Sin had hardened their hearts. They stole from the defenseless travellers, robbed women and children of their homes and God's blessings. They didn't care about their future. All they cared about was themselves. And the prophets speak of wealth and prosperity. But Micah turns around and says, they're empty falsehoods. You're wasting your time. What's exciting about this book, when we look at the three parts, and what's the time now? Sorry about this, folks. You're going to be here longer than you thought. But it's that at the end of each of these little sections, there's a glimmer of hope. And in this part, there's two verses of hope. And as you go along, it's more and more. And I think what I'll do, Graham, is I'll start praising what I'm doing, not repeating so much, because you still won't remember it. But the last two verses in the second chapter is something of hope. It starts off saying, and we all accept this, I hope, that God must punish us when we're disobedient and unrepentant. But he says in time, God is going to bring his people together. Like a sheep, he'll draw them close to himself. He'll guide them. He'll deliver them. There will be a Messiah who will set them free. He will be at their head, leading them, clearing any obstacles. And we see suddenly that there is this glimmer of hope. The next sort of what I call the second sermon, goes on for the next two and a half chapters, and again, it looks back at people's sinfulness in more detail. It looks at leaders. Basically, the leaders are neglecting their duties, and in doing so, are suggesting that they hate God. There's pictures of them being like cannibals, devouring people, devouring all that they have. The corridors of power have become evil and sinful. And I wrote that down there because the corridors of power is often used to describe our own parliament, isn't it? Is this actually talking into our lives here and now? It talks about people who are not shepherding the sheep, people who are ignoring cries for help and expect God to listen to them. We all desire justice. It's one thing we all want. Sometimes we might not recognise it, might not be able to define it. But when we see injustice, doesn't it really make you annoyed? Does it make you sort of want to do something to fight against it? When the government is corrupt, as this one was, the only answer is for it to be overthrown. The only answer is for God to deal with it. And then Micah goes on, talking about the prophets and what they were doing. They were misleading people, turning people away from God. They were manipulated by their greed. I don't know if prophets do it nowadays, but that they were asking for payments, or should I say demanding payments. And if you didn't give them enough, then they abused you. If you paid them enough, they gave you a great prophecy, a prophecy of a peaceful and successful and bright future. But for everybody else who wouldn't pay them enough, it was something the exact opposite. This had become their way of life. Instead of bringing God's word to the people, instead of declaring what God wanted to tell his people to guide them, they were just really taking money for absolute rubbish that they gave out. And God says that he would judge them, their gifts will be removed, they will be disgraced, and he will never ever answer their cries. But Micah is the true prophet. And in verse 8, there's just that short little passage where he talks about being led by God's Spirit. But he speaks out for justice. He warns people about the results of their sin in the hope that they will repent. And that is the sort of thing that we need today, isn't it? We need people who will speak out, people who will declare God's word, people who will stand up for all the things that are wrong. And, you know, I sort of look back to years ago, some people who in history, not ancient history, but in my lifetime, have been slated by the press for standing up and speaking out on behalf of God's people. And, I never hear that sort of thing nowadays. I just wonder whether it's because we've taken a back seat because it's not politically correct to oppose other people or talk about your faith. But this whole book goes on and talks more and more about the evil of the time, the evil of the leaders, and it talks about, I'll just mention the temple, a visible sign of God's presence will be taken away if Jerusalem is destroyed. But the good news is that we know what happened. The good news is that through King Hezekiah, the people repented. God forced the Assyrian army to be destroyed and to flee. But 100 years later, they were destroyed. But where is the visible sign of God's presence today? It's one of the questions I was asking myself. Because we might turn around and say it's in the food banks, or it's in the night shelter. It's where Christians are doing something for people. But where is God's visible sign of his presence? Is it in the church? Is it part of our lives? Where is it today? Where are the things of God being done that make a difference to people's lives? That really is something I just felt the church should be about. It's not about the priests here where they're doing religion, they're doing the things that make themselves look good, to make themselves rich. But it's about doing something that changes people's lives. It's about doing God's will. I just want to nip on now. I'm going to run through this right to the end. And I've got a lot of writing, so I'm just missing it. Because I say it goes on and on and on, looking at the same thing, talking about the sin of the leaders, what they're doing. In fact, judgment is going to come. And then a short bit about there is hope in the end. And in chapter 5, you all remember, I'm sure half of you could recite it without having a Bible in front of you, but I need to get things right. It's great, isn't it? It's like things like the grace, when we stand up to say the grace, and the person at the front goes, "Now we'll say the grace," and they go, "I've forgotten it." How does it start? But in chapter 5, "But you, O Bethlehem of Ephrathah, who are one of the little clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me one who is to rule in Israel, whose origin is from old, from ancient days." And that is just one of the great promises of hope that come out of this book, that out of this small place, someone is going to come who is going to lead them forever. And I just want to nip through towards the end. I think this last part, after Micah has for the third time talked about their sin and corruption and what's going to happen to them, he then turns round and he talks about the second coming, about God's glorious future he's going to bring. And in that, I'll just mention a few of the things, but what's so exciting is there's this picture that God is going to build this new Jerusalem. He's going to come back to Zion. And there, people will run in to be taught his ways. That sounds exciting to me. People coming in. But people from the ends of the earth are coming in. People who were historically the enemies of Israel will be coming in. And they will come to be saved. They will come to be part of God's everlasting kingdom, where the good shepherd will rule forever. And it is a really wonderful picture that after we go through history, there's a time when God is going to bring all the evil in this world to an end. He's going to bring it to an end. And he's going to create a new world where we live, which is beyond our wildest dreams. But right at the end here, and it's verse 18, Micah turns around and he says, "Who is a God like you, pardoning iniquity and passing over the transgression of the remnant of your possession? He does not retain his anger forever, because he delights in showing clemency. He will again have compassion upon us. He will tread our iniquities underfoot and will cast all our sins into the depths of the sea." And you get this final picture, this final wonderful picture, where he uses his own name, which is, you know, who is a God like Yahweh, and says, our God is someone amazing and awesome and unique. He will forgive. When we confess our sin, when we confess our guilt, when we ask for forgiveness, as Micah had done, we've been bought with a price. We are special to God. We're called into a special relationship with him. And we come and worship a God who delights in mercy. Not for his own gain, not because he wants you all to think he's great, but because he's a merciful God, because he loves us, he's not going to be angry forever, and he will remain faithful to his covenant. And I just saw that last bit and thought, wow, you know, here in the Old Testament is another one of these excellent pictures of a God who loves us, a God who has compassion for us, a God who, though we don't deserve any of his love, loves us because he loves us. He loves us not because of who we are, but because of who we could become in Jesus Christ. He deals with our sin. I know that last bit where it says they're thrown into the depths of the sea. A lot of people turn around and say, and then he puts a sign up and saying, no fishing. Ernie's a good one for using that one. Being a fisherman, I think that's brilliant. But it's amazing how we still haven't managed to get down to the depths of the sea. We've been up to the moon, but can't get down to the depths of the sea. And God has sort of, in a sense, thrown all our sin to a place where it can't be dragged up again and presented before us. It can't be used against us. And so, this book, and I'm going to end here, is a book, yes, of describing a land that is desperate, a land that is going to be judged, a land that is going to be torn apart. But it's a real book of hope, because Micah is crying out to his people saying, look, you've gone wrong, but if you simply turn back to God and confess your sin, then you'll be part of what his will, part of what he wants for you. And that is the message for our nation, really, that no matter how far we transgress, no matter how far we walk away from God, that God is also willing to reach out and draw us back. And I come back to that question again, that is this a book for today? Is this a message for today? Because every time I read through it, I couldn't help think of something that happened a few years ago. So some of you might be too young for this, but yeah, when the stock exchange crashed and everybody who had a wonderful pension thought, there's my life gone down the drain. Disaster hit us and financially everything just went into a horrible mess. And we all thought, it's the bankers that got us into this problem. It's the financial people because of their greed. And, you know, we've all got certain feelings about it. But did we ever learn any lessons from that? Because the more I talk to people in financial world, the more I realise that they're all getting the big bonuses again, even though they're not making so much money. So often something happens and we don't learn from it. And this nation of Israel is just one of these examples of where God gives them another chance and they didn't learn from it. And God gives each one of us another chance and another chance and another chance. And the question is, will we ever learn from it? I'm going to stop there because Graham, I'm sure, has got loads of questions and comments to make.
Right, thanks, Bernie. Okay. A few things struck me about Micah. There are lots of these minor prophets, and there are these major prophets, and we always tend to see them in isolation, don't we? You get bits from each of them. You think, oh yes, Isaiah says this, Micah says that, Nahum says that, Habakkuk says that, and we kind of see them in isolation. And it's quite hard work, but actually when you put them kind of chronologically together, you actually realise how much they all connect and how much they're all prophesying and talking about the same things. As Bernie said, Micah covered the reign of three kings, which potentially could have been anything from 30 to 60 years between all those kings of Judah. And the thing was that what was going on in Israel and Judah was not something straightforward and simple. It's not one issue. There were so many things going on. This was a horrendously turbulent time. Under Hezekiah, as well as the others, we think Hezekiah, he was a good king, things were all wonderful. They weren't. He didn't do everything right. Israel was in a worse mess. There were at least four kings, because some of these kings lasted weeks or months before somebody went and killed them and they took over. And what you also don't pick up just from reading the prophets is that bits of Israel and Judah were getting invaded, and they were attacking in each other and invading each other, and all sorts of things went wrong. It's interesting to see that at the same time as Micah, Hosea was prophesying. And Isaiah was also prophesying over the same period. So it would be really good, I haven't done it, to actually connect them all together and see how they fit. But what's interesting is that it's not just one prophet at one time. God had more than one person saying, things are wrong, you've got to do something. And in all these prophecies, you find God prophesies the destruction. He says, if you carry on this way, this is what's going to happen. He says, this is what you're doing wrong. And there's always the message of hope. Hope for if they turn round and look into the future hope. Looking to Jesus and the second coming. Prophecy goes short distances, medium distances, and long distances. And sometimes it's difficult to tell which is which. Also, to put this into a little bit of context, at the beginning of Micah's ministry was sort of the time when Rome was founded. The Greek Empire was kind of really in its classic period, and you had the Olympics had started. At one point during this time, Ethiopia takes over Egypt. There are world events going on at the same time. And when you think, well, maybe the prophets, especially Micah, are being a bit hard, you know, terrible destruction, you know, was it that bad? Well, one of the things that happened was that King Ahaz wanted to pay off Assyria so they didn't attack him. So he robbed the temple of its gold and silver to pay off the king of Assyria. I mean, can you imagine something that sacrilegious going on? These prophets had good reason to say what they were saying. And also, in this time of Ahaz, when he is also attacking Judah, you have Isaiah giving the prophecy, a virgin shall give birth to a son. So these prophets prophesying at this time are also prophesying about Jesus and giving us a lot of our well-known Christmas quotes. So these prophets, which can seem a bit irrelevant, actually are very relevant. And it's worth getting stuck into them. That's what I had to say. Hope that's okay. Right. Do you want to stand up and stretch your legs, get a drink or something? And then we will have a few questions. I hope we've thought up some questions to make Bernie Squirm. Would you like to do that? No, I'm hoping you're going to answer them. You're the one who studied it.